This, I thought I'd reflect on metta practice because it's this attitude of metta is very important, especially towards oneself, because I notice most of us are very critical, and it's hard to develop equanimity or relate to kind of the that balanced attitude of equanimity if you basically don't like yourself or you're very critical of yourself. Just in the West, where Buddhism is developing, people find Buddha Rupas maybe a bit intimidating because they represent equanimity, really enlightened equanimity. So, on a personal level, this can be quite intimidating because we admire it and kind of. Feel it's wonderful and high, but we can't relate to it in terms of our own experience. So you can see a lot of interest in the Kuan Yin and more kind of expressions of compassion as icons or symbols of compassion or metta, metta, karuna. And mudita, then upeka, of course, equanimity. Because in many ways we can relate to compassion, like we're all good-hearted, usually feel compassion for the suffering of others, the animals and the downtrodden and the unfortunate ones. It's not like something that is alien to us. Most of us have a lot of that, wanting to help the poor or take care of the sick or the weak, stand up for the human rights of the minorities and so forth. So that is an inspiring quality, and we can relate to it in terms of our own attitudes. Equanimity can remain like indifference. It's I'm above it all. The world just goes on according to its karma, and the poor are reaping the results of their karma, and the sick and the downtrodden and we can, and when you try to rationalize it in terms of equanimity, it sounds like a lack of concern or not wanting to be bothered or just dismissing the injustices and unfairnesses to abide in a state of blissful equanimity is how we might rationalize it. But then towards oneself, this metta is the starting point is ahang sukhito homi, so it's with may I abide in well-being. Now putting that into practical into practice, what do you do? You know, it's easy enough to say, and you understand the idea of it. It's not difficult to understand logically, intellectually. But right now, in the terms of this moment, what is it? Ahang sukhito homi. Now, is to see yourself as a person, as a kind of monolithic personality that is the same all the time, is another illusion. Is that I'm this person all the time. Ajahn Sumedho's like this, and I'm, you know, when I'm asleep or awake, or when I'm working or sitting in meditation, when I'm teaching, when I'm playing, when I'm taking a bath or eating my food, I'm the same Ajahn Sumedho all the time. This is the assumption that there's some kind of solid personality it's always the same. Notice that is a perception that we sometimes never question. We it's easy to believe I'm just the same person from when I was born 67 years ago. I was born, I wasn't Ajahn Sumedho then. I was different. Didn't even have a name when I was born. And then my mother and father found a name for me. But it's the same person, isn't it? We can assume that it's always the same. Or in terms of direct knowing, now you're not coming from the position of I am the same person, but what is person? What is personness or personality? And so that changes, isn't it? How you feel, how you think, the mood, the emotional state. Just as you're aware of your personality, you can see there's nothing solid in it. It's very ephemeral and fuzzy. I mean, most you can get a kind of solid personality. The sense of being a real person is when you're angry, when you're feeling really, when you have the clarity of focusing your aversion on somebody. You kind of feel more together than when you don't have a strong emotional state, kind of uncertain, insecure, don't know what to do, wavering. Then your personality is, you can't. It's so amorphous, nebulous. Or lust, and one feels, sexual desire, one feels comes together very strongly as a, aiming at some desired object. You feel pretty strong and focused as a person. A righteous indignation, to be indignant about the injustices of the society, and to really harangue the society about how stupid and how unfair and unjust and terrible they are. To come from a righteous place, it makes one feel very together, a sense of being a really strong character rather than this weak, amorphous, uncertain, wishy-washy thing. So metta then includes all of these different personalities. That metta, ahaṃ sukhito homi, isn't ahaṃ sukhito homi in the sense of the assumption of me as a kind of solid personality that's the same all the time. But it's an attitude of acceptance, welcoming, non-criticalness, of all these different, this gamut, this range of emotional experience, emotional, intellectual, instinctual feelings, activities. So it gives this sense of a embracing, you know, so I talk about welcoming, embracing, and this is metta, applied metta practice. Because it is, it's not approval, it's not saying, it's not making a value judgment or a moral judgment about anything, is it? It's just, it's like this, whatever, feeling wishy-washy, weak and stupid is like this, righteously indignant, arrogant, and as is like this, being lustful, greedy, like this. And metta then allows these conditions. That's not saying when you start criticizing or preferring one over the other, then there's no longer metta, and you're trying to get rid of the things you don't like and try to hold on to the things you do. So then you're back in the realm of desire, the desire realm. So for me, like icons that tend to welcome can be very, good reminders of these Kuan Yin, Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara icons, even though they're Mahayana, because we're not Mahayana, are we? We get into, do we dare use Mahayana in Theravada, or is that spoiling the purity of our tradition? And get into this kind of speculation again. But recognize that religious conventions they're not pure, they're conventional. So you're not going to find any purity in any convention. It's not a matter of not spoiling the purity of our tradition. That can be another arrogant, self-righteous position we take. But if we feel that way, then we can be aware of our fear or our views about other traditions. The way we can just dismiss. It's easy. I hear a lot of Theravadins dismiss Mahayana. Just because it's not Theravada, then we just kind of, it's not the real Buddha's teaching, and dismiss it. Because our security depends on maybe an affirmation of our tradition as being somehow the best or the right one. But metta includes all of this, doesn't it? Our self-right, our fear, our anxiety, our insecurity. And then it's metta embraces and allows insecurity to be insecure, or fear to be fearful. So when we say it's like this, it's this is just a way of allowing something we might resist a lot, allowing it to be conscious. It's like this, like fear is like this. That, to me, when I say that to myself, if I'm feeling frightened or threatened by something, then it helps me to remind myself to just accept this, to embrace this feeling of fear, to allow it to be conscious, rather than my personality reaction would be to resist it, to try to get rid of it, see it as something I've got to get rid of, conquer, got to conquer my arrogant side of my personality wants to conquer. Because in my warrior positioning, I don't want to be a frightened, cowardly man. Pusillanimous pussycat. You know, my image, my masculine image wants to support myself as kind of brave, courageous, tough. And conqueror, the conqueror. So that's then there's another side. It is weak, frightened, pusillanimous. I don't like that. And I don't want anybody to see that, you know, when you're worldly life. I don't want anyone to see that. I present myself as a champion conqueror. This is the world, isn't it? This conflict that we create. So metta then includes both. It's not judging the conquering energy and the as being something I shouldn't have, or it's not judging the weak, the cowardly side, the frightened side. It's being frightened and feeling weak. Is like this. A feeling brave and courageous is like this. So it's reflecting on the way it is, the changing conditions are the way they are. So, like patient, like this, learning to accept things takes patience to allow misery and pain, and that doesn't mean like you're not conquering, an attitude of conquering pain and conquering your weaknesses. That's not metta. That's the world again, worldly attitude. So, getting back to the metta practice of may I abide in well-being towards all the conditions that you might be experiencing. non-judging, taking an interest, welcoming even weakness and worry, anxiety. So then, this is getting back to the Buddha in the Puto. This, I've used this as my lifetime mantra, Puto, and it's this is like the Thai forest tradition. It's their kind of the thing that they, I mean, almost all the forest Ajahns teach, Ajahn Man, Ajahn Chah. Is a mantric form of the Buddha, Bhutto. And this, and then translated as the one that knows, the one who knows, or the pure knowing, the awakened state of being. So the Bhutto is the pure consciousness, pure awareness. And so taking refuge in the Buddha, the Bhutang Sarangachami is this. To me, this is what it means. Bhutto is a mantra. But it's not just a kind of mesmerizing, hypnotizing use of a word, you know, just kind of hypnotize myself with these two syllables. But it can be used as that. But also, it's to remind that what is the Bhutto right now? So this is inquiring, self-inquiry. In terms of right now, what is the Buddha? Where is the Buddha? So this is like a question. And if it's just a belief in some historical figure, That's just some kind of perception, isn't it? You're holding to some perception of Buddha, which comes and goes. Perceptions of Buddha are like, you know, you can study Buddhology and read the history of the Lord Buddha and that. But that's only perception. That's sanya, sankara. So then what my mind does when I do this is it goes into this state of just awareness, this pure, I find it naturally, it kind of settles into this, like a settling effect. As I stop trying to find the Buddha and think about it and define it and question and get myself all in a twist around, what is the Buddha? Where is the Buddha? Trying to figure it out. As I just use it as a way of just being aware. settle into this pure state of pure consciousness. Where I can hear this sound of silence. No, I kind of surrender to that. I just kind of release, relief. This attitude of patience, or this word surrender, or relaxation. Some people don't like the word surrender, but relaxation, relaxing. Trusting, letting go of everything so you can just trust in this refuge of pure consciousness where there's awareness. Knowing, there's a knowing. But it's not focused on anything in particular. It's a not knowing about or thinking about anything, but just conscious attention that embraces this present moment completely and all it that appears in our consciousness. It's non-critical. So it embraces the body, isn't it? The breath, any mood, thoughts, memories that you're experiencing now, it includes everything. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. It includes physical pain, or it includes bad moods. It includes good and bad, neutral, coarse and refined. Nothing, and everything it belongs. So this way of reflecting, and we don't have just learning to trust, relax and trust in the present moment. Simple as that. Nothing you have to do. Like, you don't have to spend your time trying to purify yourself and get rid of your desires and make yourself into a better person and try to prove yourself and purify yourself, solve all your problems, all this kind of thinking. It includes it even a metaphor for this kind of thinking, all these compulsive feelings of having to get something or become something that we're not, or get rid of our weaknesses, our anger, our bad thoughts, our dirty thoughts. Our selfishness, we've got to get rid of selfishness. So notice that this kind of is dhanha, this gama dhanha, bhava dhanha, vipava dhanha. Desire always has this quality of there's something I've got to do. You know, I've got to get something I don't have yet. I've got to get rid of what I have that isn't any good. There's always this feeling of impending doom, of there's something I've got to get. I've got to get enlightened. I've got to practice harder. I've got to purify myself. I've got to get rid of my impurity. So these are the bhava dhanha vipava dhanha that we easily identify or attach to, and then get intimidated all the time. And then it's endless, you know. It just goes on and on and on. You know, if you never get beyond dhanha, even after years in the robe, you're never going to feel pure enough or good enough or wise enough. You know, that's why people get so discouraged, because they put a lot of faith in becoming samanas, and then they think that it's going to purify them. If you live celibate, if you eat vegetarian food, if you refrain from dancing, singing, worldly activities, sensual indulgences, refrain from all that, and kind of make yourself into some kind of pure state of purity through discipline. And so then we try, and if we get caught into that, then it's such a disappointment, trying to be good and pure as a willful act. Because something in you dies too. And then you go blank. You become kind of, you know, depressed and lifeless. So like bhava dhanha, vipava dhamma dhanha, three kinds of desire, is and these desires recognize are to be welcomed. Like to let go of desire doesn't mean you're annihilating it and destroying it. When letting go of desire is not an attack, a demolishing, an annihilation of desire. It's welcoming, accepting desire, knowing desire. Dhanha is like this. It's wanting to become something. Wanting to become even a good monk or a good nun, or wanting to become an arahant. Wanting to get rid of all your defilements. And these can be very righteous. You know, it seems right, doesn't it, to get rid of your defilements. It seems right to me, in my logical mind. You know, you should get rid of your bad habits, and you should develop good ones. You should develop skillful means, and you should let go and get rid of your bad habits. And say, that's true. I agree completely. But then we're coming now out of the intellectual, rational world toward the reality of this moment. That comes out of the thinking process. So it's very dualistic. You know, you can't get perspective. you can't get perspective on things through thinking about them, through just following your thoughts. So that's why you have this true but not right, right but not true problem. You know, it's true. To develop skillful means is good, and to let go and get rid of bad habits is right. But now we're coming into a place of awareness rather than of reason and logic. So this is sati sampajanya, satipanya, intuitive awareness, which embraces this feeling, I've got to get something, I've got to purify myself. You can be aware of that as a trying to, a bhavadanha, isn't it? Wanting to become something. You know, wanting to attain something, wanting to, even if it's something very good, it's still bhavadanha, as long as it's coming out of ignorance. Or vipavadana, trying to get rid of bad habits of anger and jealousy, fear, trying to kill the kilesas, get rid of your defilement. It's like this. So I listen, you know, listen inwardly to gamadanha is quite simple enough, isn't it? Wanting sense pleasure. Just, you know, the sense world, this world that we live in is sensual world. It's sensual, it's attractive and it's repulsive. You know, there's endless attractions through the senses. That's just natural. You know, that's the way it is. That's what is attractive is, you know, one feels attracted towards what is attractive. It's just the way it is. But taking it personally, isn't it, is where it gets off the track. And being repelled by what is ugly and that is certainly natural. And wanting to get rid of pain and physical pain and discomfort. But then we complicate it, and we get into, we shouldn't have sensual desires. We shouldn't be attracted to the beautiful. We shouldn't feel that, you know, sensual attraction is bad. We get into puritanism, kind of puritanical positions. Vipavadanha, I've got to get rid of sensual desires. I've got to get rid of lust and greed and those nasty things that pull me into the sense world. All those attractive things and sensual pleasures. I've got to destroy that kind of desires, vipavadanha. So it's if you're into that, you know, if your practice is around like asceticism, is a vipavadanha approach. You know, so you're caught in the cycle all the time. There's no liberation as long as you believe in this dualism of I've got to hold on to the good and get rid of the bad. So in the sati sampajanya, this transcendent awareness, you can actually see these are mental conditions, bhavadanha, vipavadanha. We create them. They're aramana. They're objects. mental objects, mental formations. So I can hear, like, the rantings, you know. No, I don't have this problem. Because I've explored it so much for so many years. I've been a monk for 35, 36 years now. I've had a lot of time to investigate all this. The rantings used to be kind of a perpetual blokey of trying to purify myself. And then the inner tyrant just ranting about, you know, any kind of foolish thought. Then I couldn't even, you know, just dirty thought or small-mindedness, selfishness. Then this thing was, you shouldn't. You've got to purify yourself. You've got to get rid of those kind of things. You've got to, you know, then you look at the other monks and you think, they don't have those problems. They're all so pure. Or you look at Lumpa Chan and you think, oh, he's pure. And I'm not. And I've got to get rid of impurities and become pure. Then listening to this scenario, I'm impure and I've got to become pure. What is that coming from? That's a creation, isn't it? I'm creating. Those are words. Those are identities that I see myself as a person, as a pure or impure person. I've never been able to see myself as a pure person. Because my personality is basically impure. It's just the way it is. So I've given up trying to have a pure personality. It's a waste of time anyway. There's another delusion. So what is purity? Isn't in the personal, isn't by becoming a pure person, is it? But it's purity, our natural pure consciousness. It's pure when we're trusting in awareness. We're in a state of pure, a natural purity. It's not a personal attainment. I can't claim it as some kind of my purity. Doesn't make sense saying my purity as a personal attainment. It's not like that. So, like desire, the desire realm is like this. Desire is a starting point, you know, like you're not trying to get rid of desire. We're not here to get rid of our desires. If you're here to get rid of your desires, then start seeing that this is something you're creating. I'm somebody that has desires, and I got to get rid of them. Just note that this might be the assumption you're making about practice, about being a monk or a nun. or desire is to be, you know, like, to be understood. Dukkha is to be understood. Desire is to be understood, to know it. This is a desire realm, this sense realm. It's all about desire, isn't it? The beautiful, the ugly. We desire the beautiful, and we desire to get rid of the ugly. So the desire realm is, we're not trying to demolish, not Armageddon and the kind of annihilation of the world because it's bad, but knower of the world, loka vidu. So the world, desire, these are, he can be dukkha, they all mean the same thing, really. Suffering, dukkha, desire, the world. So the Buddha is not the destroyer of the world. We say loka vidu, the knower of the world. So when you're observing, even your aspiration to get rid of your bad, your weaknesses and your bad habits, what is that? You know, like really contemplate that. What does it feel like? The sense of wanting to get rid of something, a feeling that there's something wrong with you, then you've got to get rid of it. Find out what's wrong and get rid of it. What is that like in terms of energetically at this moment? What is it like to feel this sense of, I've got to get rid of something. I've got to change. I've got to get rid of my bad habits. And when I do this, then I notice this. I deliberately think it, you know, I think it and listen to myself. I've got to get rid of my bad habits. And then there's awareness, and then there's this mental state of, I've got something that I shouldn't have, I've got to get rid of it. That's a Buddha knowing the Dhamma, seeing this Dhamma, condition, Dhamma, as putting it as a sankhara and clinging to it, or seeing it in terms of it's Dhamma, it's what arises ceases. And if you stay with that feeling, don't try to, you know, that's not analyzing yourself anymore, but just noticing this something wrong with me, this feeling of something I've got to do, something I've got to get, is like this. And if you learn to embrace that feeling and welcome it, let it be the way it is. It drops away. That's the end of the world, the cessation of desire. And what is that like? then you cessation and the path, the Fourth Noble Truth. When you begin to realize and recognize the ending of conditions, it's a reality, it's not a theory. And it's simple enough, is if you're patient and willing and accepting, then things naturally cease. It's not me trying to get rid of them. It's just the way it is, the cessation. And then we see the path, this way of awareness. Samaditti, sammasangappo, samma vaja, samma gamanto, samma chiva, samma vayamo, samma sati, samma samadhi. Put it into eight folds. I mean, this is eightfold path, but it is merely a moment of this awareness, the realization of something that we used to be attached to and identified with. It's gone now. It's absent. There's still the bhuto, the awareness. But this awareness now isn't, it's not attached to anything. It's not a personal attainment. It's just very natural, conscious, relaxed state of being. So this is like monastic life. In anything like this that we live in this tradition, notice that we have our heroes and our icons of, you know, what really good monks are and so forth. And we have, you know, Ajahn Mun, and we have Ajahn Chah now as an icon. When you're dead, you become an icon. So you know, you have Ajahn Chah stories, and Ajahn Chah, just like Ajahn Mun stories. Who knows what Ajahn Mun was like as a human being? All you've got left is a kind of icon of him. So recognize that these are inspired, these inspire the mind. And inspiration helps. It is like, you know, can give you a boost, gets you going, but it's not a refuge. You can't depend on inspiration as something that's going to take you to enlightenment. So we can get intimidated. We think Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, or the Buddha, or the great, like the great teachers of the past. You can even see, you know, probably some of you project onto me all kinds of things, you know, of kind of ideals and hopes. And when I die, if I don't screw it up before I die, then I'll become an icon. And probably if I screw up, they'll become an icon. but this isn't, this is the, you know, this is just the sannyasankara. But then on a personal level, to compare yourselves to an icon is ridiculous, isn't it? So, I mean, you know, you can only feel you're not as good. I mean, you know, looking at the Buddha Rupa, I can only feel, I'm never going to look that good. So, personally, I feel intimidated by that Buddha Rupa because it makes me feel inferior. That's not what it's there for, and that's how we can use icons, but not grasp them. So we're not trying to become Ajahn Chahs or Ajahn Muns or Buddhas. Or we hear in the Tibetan tradition, they have all these, like Milarepa, and these kind of Padmasambhava, and all these kind of marvelous figures of that did all these fantastic ascetic practices, you know, living on nettle soup and living out in a cave and doing all kinds of fantastic kind of, you know, physical endurance tests. We can feel very intimidated by all that. So what we can know is that, you know, when we're presented with these icons of perfection or ideals of humanity, then how do you feel about it? You know, say, if I say, this is what you should be like Milarepa. Yeah. What you can know is what you feel when I say that. And, I mean, that's a direct knowing. That's something, if you trust in that awareness of what you are feeling, so I'm intimidating you. I'm saying you should be like Ajahn Mun, very strict, impeccable monk. And then you have these ideals of, you know, you're not very strict, you're not impeccable, I can't do it, I'm not good enough, I'm not as good as Ajahn. That's a feeling, isn't it? If that intimidation, you feel a sense of being inferior, is like this. So this is what I'm trying to encourage as a path, is awareness. You know, to trust in it. It's something to trust in your ability to know what you're feeling, and not know about it in terms of what you should or shouldn't feel, but know that this feeling of being not good enough is like this, or this feeling of being better than somebody else is like this. Sometimes we feel we're superior to somebody. You know, I'm much, you know, I keep the rules much better than you do. I get up at 2:30 in the morning and do exercises. That makes me better than most of you. You can't do that. So then the Ajahn Sumedho groupies, they, Ajahn Sumedho gets up at 2:30 in the morning. We should get up at 2:30 in the morning. I mean, how do you feel when somebody says that? You know, this is to trust in that awareness of what you are feeling, and whether it's, you know, you're a party liner, or you're a rebel, or you're just... you feel, you know, very intimidated or insecure by by all these superlative examples, what you can know is that this is the way I'm feeling. The feeling, the emotional reaction is like this. So that, just pointing that out, to trust that, is, to me, this is what I call developing the path, cultivating the, because real bhavana is, when we talk about bhavana in the Pali word bhavana, which is used in the Fourth Noble Truth, there is the Eightfold Path, the way of non-suffering. It should be cultivated or developed, which is bhavana. They use the word bhavana. So this is, to me, what bhavana is. And in Thailand, they use bhavana is a word for meditation. In fact, the head monk at Wat Puttaparthip, the Tanjau Khun, the head monk at Wat, the Thai temple in London, his name is Tanjau Khun Pawana. So Pawana, this is Pawana is not ascetic, is it? It's not like fighting your defilements and trying to make yourself perfect, but it's awareness of this. It's seeing this, trusting, because you can't get behind it. You can only be this, the awake, you know, trust in awakened attention. And the path then is being able to see your, you know, what you ought to acknowledge and accept what you are, what is conscious at this moment, through physical or emotional conditioning.